which is VGSIX. Now, on the bond part of the portfolio, 5% might be in short-term treasury index fund, that's VSBSX. 5% might be in the intermediate-term treasury index fund, VSIGX. 5% in the Vanguard short-term treasury index fund, VSBSX. And 15% in short-term inflation-protected securities index fund, VTAPX. These are just a few of the literally thousands of index funds that exist. You can be flexible with the funds. If you want to be more or less aggressive, you can change the allocation to match your risk tolerance. For example, if you look at those funds and you say, man, I'll never get around to owning 7 funds, then just be realistic with yourself. Maybe you want to buy the stock funds, but maybe just one bond fund for now. Maybe you don't need to think about treasury inflation-protected securities yet. Pick the number of funds that will let you get started, realizing that you can adjust it later on to get a balanced asset allocation. Spend time identifying the funds that will help you build a full, balanced asset allocation over time. You don't need to get all 7 funds I listed. Even one is better than nothing, but you should have a list of funds that you'll eventually buy to round out your allocation. Keep it manageable. Question: how many funds should I invest in? Answer: if you're wondering how many funds you should own, I'd encourage you to keep it simple. Ideally, you should have just one, which is a target date fund. But if you're picking your own index funds, as a general guideline, you can create a great asset allocation using anywhere from 3 to 7 funds. That would cover domestic equities, international equities, real estate investment trusts, and perhaps a small allocation to treasury bonds. Remember, the goal isn't to be exhaustive and to own every single aspect of the market. It's to create an effective asset allocation and move on with your life. Dollar cost averaging, investing slowly over time. When I want to sound smart and intimidate people, I calmly look at them, chew on a muffin for a few seconds, and then throw it against a wall and scream, "Do you dollar cost average?" People are often so impressed that they slowly inch away, then whisper to people around them. I can only guess that they're discussing how suave and knowledgeable I am. Dollar cost averaging is a phrase that refers to investing regular amounts over time, rather than investing all your money in a fund at once. Now, why would you do this? Well, imagine you invest $10,000 tomorrow and the stock drops 20%. At $8,000, it will need to increase 25%, not 20%, to get back to $10,000. By investing at regular intervals over time, you hedge against drops in price. And if your fund does drop, you'll pick up shares at a discount price. In other words, by investing over time, you don't try to time the market. You use time to your advantage. This is the essence of automatic investing, which lets you consistently invest in a fund so you don't have to guess when the market is going up or down. In Chapter 5, we covered your automatic infrastructure. To set up automatic investing, configure your accounts to automatically pull a set amount of money from your checking account each month. Remember, if you set it up, most funds will waive transaction fees. But here's an interesting question. If you have a pile of money to invest, what's the better option? Should you dollar cost average it, or should you invest the entire lump sum all at once? The answer might surprise you. Vanguard research found that lump sum investing actually beats dollar cost averaging 2/3 of the time. Because the market tends to go up and stocks and bonds tend to outperform cash, investing all at once produces higher returns in most situations. But, and there are several buts, this isn't true if the market is going down. Of course, nobody can predict where the market will go, especially in the short term. And investing isn't just about math, but about the very real effects of your emotions on your investing behavior. In short, most of us already dollar cost average since we take part of our monthly paycheck and invest it. But if you have a lump sum of money, most of the time you'll get better returns by investing it all at once. Buying into individual index funds. Once you've got a list of index funds that you want to own in your portfolio, usually 3 to 7 funds, start buying them one by one. If you can afford to buy into all the funds at once, go for it. But a lot of people can't do this since the minimum for each fund might be between $1,000 and $3,000. Just like with a target date fund, you want to set a savings goal to accumulate enough to pay for the minimum of the first fund. Then you'll buy into that fund, continue investing a small amount in it, and set a new savings goal to get the next fund. Investing isn't a race. You don't need a perfect asset allocation tomorrow. So here's how to handle buying multiple index funds over time. Let's say you check your conscious spending plan from Chapter 4, and it allows you to invest $500 a month after contributing to your 401k. Well, assuming all your funds have a $1,000 minimum, you'd set a savings goal of $1,000 for Index Fund 1 and save for 2 months. Once you accumulated enough to cover the minimum, transfer that $1,000 from saving to your investing account and buy the fund. Now, set up a contribution of $100 a month to the fund you just bought. And then take the remaining $400 a month that you set aside for investing. Remember, that's $500 total minus the $100 that you're currently investing in Index Fund 1, and start another savings goal towards Index Fund 2. Once you've saved enough, buy Index Fund 2. Repeat this process as necessary. Sure, it may take a few years to get to the point where you own all the index funds you need, but remember, you're taking a 40 or 50 year outlook on investing. It's not about the short term. This is hard, and this is the cost of constructing your own perfect portfolio. Yet another reason why I love target date funds instead of individual index funds. Note, once you own all the funds you need, you can split the money across funds according to your asset allocation. But don't just split it evenly. Remember, your asset allocation determines how much money you invest in different areas. If you have $250 a month to invest and you buy 7 index funds, the average person, who knows nothing, which is most people, will split the money 7 ways and send $35 to each. That's wrong. Don't do that. Depending on your asset allocation, you'll send more money or less money to various funds. You can use this calculation. Your total amount of monthly investing money times your percentage of asset allocation for a particular investment equals the amount you'll invest there. I'll give you an example. If you're investing $1,000 a month and your Swenson allocation recommends 30% for domestic equities, then you would calculate $1,000 times 0.3 equals $300, and you would put $300 towards your domestic equity fund. Repeat for all the other funds in your portfolio. Finally, if you opt for investing in your own index fund, you'll have to rebalance about once a year, which will help keep your funds in line with your target asset allocation. I'll cover that in the next chapter. What about other kinds of investments? There are many different investments besides stocks, bonds, and index and target date funds. You can invest in precious metals, real estate, private startups, cryptocurrency, or even art. Just don't expect very good returns. And despite all my dire warnings, you can also buy a couple of individual stocks and companies if you really want to. Real estate. For most Americans, their home is their biggest investment. And yet, as investments go, your primary residence is not a very good one for individual investors. Why? Because the returns are generally poor, especially when you factor in costs like maintenance and property taxes, which renters don't pay for, but homeowners do. Now, I'll cover real estate a lot more in Chapter 9, but in general, most people confuse their house with an investment that they buy and sell for profit. Think about it. Who sells their house for profit and keeps the money? If your parents ever sold their house, did they move into a smaller house and enjoy the rest of that money? No, they rolled it over to a down payment for their next, probably more expensive house. You want to keep each part of your portfolio balanced, so no one area overshadows the rest. Now, if you're spending $2,000 a month on your mortgage and you don't have enough left over to diversify into other areas, that's not a balanced portfolio. If you do buy real estate, regardless of whether it's to live in or to invest in, be sure to keep funding the rest of your investment areas, whether that's a target date fund or your own portfolio of index funds. Art. Art advisors report annual returns for the index of fine art sales to be around 10%. However, As research done by Stanford analysts in 2013 found, quote, the returns of fine art have been significantly overestimated and the risk underestimated. They found that the real annual return of art over the past four decades is closer to 6.5% versus the 10% that's commonly claimed. The main reason for this overestimation is due to selection bias, in which the repeat sale of popular pieces isn't taken into account. Also, by choosing particular art pieces as investments, you're essentially doing the same thing as trying to predict winning stocks. And after listening to Chapter 6, you already know how hard that is to do. In aggregate, art investments may be quite profitable, but the trick is choosing which individual pieces will appreciate. And as you can imagine, that isn't easy. I want to show you how hard it is to select art as an investment. For that, we turn to the Wall Street Journal, which wrote about John Maynard Keynes's massive art collection. In 2018 dollars, he spent $840,000 to amass an art collection that's now worth $99 million. Now that works out to 10.9% per year, an excellent return, except for one thing. Two pieces of art account for half the value of the collection. Just think about that. One of the world's best art collectors carefully bought 135 pieces, and just two generated half the value of the entire collection. Could you predict which two would be worth that much? Well, for most people, the answer is no. High risk, high potential for reward investments. Life isn't just about target date funds and index funds. Lots of people understand that logically, they should create a well-diversified portfolio of low-cost funds. But a lot of people also want to have some fun investing. My take on this is, if you feel this way, sure, use a small part of your portfolio for high-risk investing. But treat it as fun money, not as money that you need. I set aside about 10% of my portfolio for fun money, which includes particular stocks that I like, know, and use. Companies like Amazon that focus on customer service, sector funds that let me focus on particular industries, like for me, healthcare, and even angel investing, which is personal investing for private, ultra early stage companies. All of these are very high risk investments, and they're funded by just for fun money that I can afford to lose. Still, there is potential for great returns. If you have the rest of your portfolio set up and you still have money left over, be smart about it. But feel free to take 5 to 10% of your investable money and put it in what you want. My counterintuitive $297,754 lesson. When you were 15 years old, a lot of your dads were showing you how to drive, or showing you how to use a razor, or throwing you a quinceañera. My dad told me to open a Roth IRA. A 15-year-old is too young to open a Roth IRA, so my dad and I opened a custodial account together at E-Trade. I had a few thousand bucks in there from some high school jobs that I'd worked at, like a pizza maker, a soccer referee, and a sales guy for an internet company, so I started looking around for what to invest in. Now, for little gangster Ramit, this was about as exciting as it got. So I started doing my research, which consisted of looking up which stocks went really high and low, because I thought, higher risk equals higher reward, and I'm young, so I can stand high risk, so I get high reward. That's about the extent of how deep my analytical rigor went. God, I hate myself. I also restricted it to tech. Why? 'Cause I understand technology. At least that's what I thought. I read magazines like the Industry Standard, which breathlessly hyped different companies as that magazine swelled to hundreds of pages during the dot-com boom, only to go bankrupt itself. And back then, of course, I thought investing meant picking individual stocks, so I ended up buying three stocks. I bought stock in a company called JDS Uniphase. I still remember the ticker, JDSU, which was an optical communications company. Result, the stock went to zero. I bought stock in a company called Excite, an early search engine, which was renamed Excite at Home after being acquired. It too went bankrupt. And then I bought roughly $11,000 in a little company called Amazon.com. My investment of a few thousand bucks turned into $297,754. Whoa! I should be proud of myself, right? Wrong. It might seem like I won, but you can learn a lot of counterintuitive lessons from this example. What are the lessons here? Well, the superficial lesson is, oh, you're so smart for picking Amazon. Wrong again. The real lesson is that that is exactly the wrong thing to take away. If that's your reaction, please listen carefully. It's important to know why you win and why you lose. I happened to win with this Amazon investment, but it wasn't because I was a good investor. Pure and simple, it was luck. It was a freakish, once-in-a-generation winner. Let's talk about the next lesson. The superficial lesson was, if you pick the next Amazon, you'll be rich. The real lesson, though, is investing isn't about picking individual stocks. Research shows that even veteran portfolio managers will, on average, fail to beat the market. I could have picked another 100 stocks, and statistically, I would never have beaten the market. This was pure luck. I've actually made much more money on long-term, low-cost investing. And a third superficial lesson. You might think getting the right stock matters a lot, but the real lesson is getting started early mattered even more. I was extremely lucky to have a dad who pushed me to start investing early. Now, if you had the same, that's awesome. But let's say you didn't grow up with parents who knew a lot about money. Or until recently, you thought the only way to invest was to pick stocks. I hear you. We all start from different places in life. Look, my dad didn't teach me how to deadlift and engage my core. We all start with the cards we're dealt with. But you've listened to this book. Now you can start investing aggressively. What about crypto? You know, I thought you only find mindless roving hordes in zombie movies until I met crypto investors. By the way, I use that term investors loosely since the majority of cryptocurrency fanboys have no other investments. They are investors in the same way that I am a mermaid because I can swim. The next time you hear someone ranting and raving about why crypto is the future, just ask them this simple, devastating question. Besides crypto, what does the rest of your portfolio look like? Their answer will instantly reveal that they are speculators, not investors, because they almost never have a diversified portfolio. Here are three answers that you're going to get. LOL, I don't invest in fiat currency. Traditional investments are so boring. You don't understand blockchain. These answers are contrarian, that's for sure. The only catch with being a contrarian is you actually have to be right. When you get one contrarian, they just sound a little crazy. Put two of them in the same room together, though, and suddenly you're witnessing a convention of people with all the hallmarks of brain-dead speculators. These people are almost always young, libertarian, and disaffected. You're not seeing a lot of people with successful careers spending 4 hours a day posting HODL, which is crypto investors' take on the word hold from buy and hold, on social media. See for yourself. Go to bitcoin.reddit.com. I got to tell you, though, gets a little quiet on that subreddit when crypto investments drop 80%. Listen, I have no problem with alternative investments when they are part of an overall portfolio. I have a real problem with mob mentalities around money-making ideas that then get rationalized and twisted from currency to investments to scathing, short-sighted criticisms of worldwide currency. To make this easy, I decided to create Ramit's Guide to Understanding Crypto as an Investment. They say, cryptocurrency is a form of currency that you can use to pay for various goods. The reality? Very few merchants accept cryptocurrency. Also, one thing people kind of seem to like is their currency being stable, meaning $1 is worth $1. What happens when your cryptocurrency swings over 25% in 1 week? That's right, people tend not to spend it because your TV might be 25% cheaper next week. They say cryptocurrency allows people to use cryptography and decentralization to remain anonymous. Reality, this is true, and there are some really valid reasons for people to purchase anonymously. However, for now, crypto largely gets used to buy drugs. They say it's better than fiat currency. Reality, if you spend more than 3 minutes talking about crypto with a fan, they will surely bring up the argument of fiat currency. This quickly progresses to referencing Nixon's 1971 decoupling from the gold standard, followed by, "Money isn't real." I just stare at them, blinking. They say, "It's not about Bitcoin, it's about blockchain." Reality: Bitcoin is one example of a cryptocurrency using blockchain technology, which uses cryptography and a decentralized architecture. And I have to say, the technology is legitimately impressive. It's also used by fans to distract from the constant failings of the actual usage, like Bitcoin and the thousands of other applications. In one hilarious study, 80% of initial coin offerings, ICO, were, quote, identified as scams. Fans ignore these and instead point to the blockchain as the panacea for all societal ills. Hungry? Blockchain will solve that. Need to walk your dog? What about using blockchain? Hey, I need to change my underwear. Got blockchain? They say, "Well, crypto is an amazing investment." Reality: investment returns in Bitcoin increased hugely in 2017. From January to June, it had increased by 240% compared to 9% for the S&P 500. Hard to argue against that. But irregular returns are a larger problem than most people realize. In just 3 months, Bitcoin soared over 340% and then dropped like a rock. Just like in any other type of high-risk gambling, you get addicted to the highs, but when it goes down, guess what happens? You begin hiding your losses and not talking about them. And true to form, that's exactly what we saw. The number of people who searched for Bitcoin soared at the same time its price did. And of course, once the price dropped, people stopped talking about Bitcoin as an investment. In crypto, you see the same signs of gambling and cult-like behavior. Questioning anything is verboten and harshly punished. Engaging in increasingly risky behavior, like borrowing money to, quote, invest in crypto. Whether prices increase or decrease, explaining it through the lens of why crypto will eventually replace all currency. Making increasingly irrational claims, such as disrupting fiat currency. Moving goalposts. It's a currency. No, it's an investment. No, we're here to change the world. Look, if you want to invest in crypto, be my guest. As I said, once you have a solid portfolio in place, I encourage you to invest 5 to 10% in something fun. Just make sure you have a fully functioning portfolio first, meaning you've completed the ladder of investing, you have 6 months of emergency funds, and you limit your exposure by periodically rebalancing. Of course, if you had a question about crypto in the first place, you're not even listening to me anymore. You're already on some Bitcoin forum chanting fiat, fiat. Why am I even recording this? Action steps, week 6. Number 1, figure out your investing style. Should take about 30 minutes. Decide whether you want the simple investment options of a target date fund or the increased control and complexity of index funds. I recommend a target date fund as the 85% solution. Number 2, research your investments. This will take you between 3 hours and a week. If you've decided on a target date fund, research the funds from Vanguard, T. Rowe Price, and Schwab. This can take a few hours. If you're constructing your own portfolio, it'll take you more time and more money to meet the minimums of each fund. If that's the case, use the Swenson model as a basic template and prioritize which funds you'll buy today and which ones you'll get later. Once you decide on an asset allocation, research funds using a fund screener. Number 3, buy your funds. And this can take you between an hour and a week. Buying a target date fund is easy. First, transfer the money to your investment account. For 401ks, you should already be directing money from each paycheck into your account. For Roth IRAs, this money should be waiting in your savings account from Chapter 5. If you don't have cash lying around to invest, set a savings goal and wait until you have enough to invest in your first fund. Once the money's ready and it's been transferred over to your investment account, log into the account, enter the ticker symbol, and you're finished. If you're buying individual index funds, you'll usually need to buy one at a time and set up savings accounts for the others. Yes! You are now an investor. And not only that, you've reached the end of the 6-week program. You've optimized your credit cards and bank accounts, and you've started investing. And even better, you've tied your system together so it works automatically with hardly any effort on your part. Now, there is just a little bit more. In the next chapter, we'll focus on how to maintain and grow your investments. Then, in the final chapter, I'll address all the random questions you have about money and life in general. But the truth is, by making it all the way through this chapter, you've already done the hard work. Chapter 8. How to maintain and grow your system. You've done the hard work. What's next? Here's how to maintain and grow your financial infrastructure to achieve your rich life. You might notice that this is one of the shortest chapters in the book. That's because you've already put the 85% solution into place, and you've dealt with the most important parts of your finances, your credit cards, bank accounts, spending, and investments. You've consciously decided what your rich life is, and you've built a financial system that is essentially on autopilot, letting you spend time pursuing the things you love. You are doing great, especially considering that most people are still struggling with paying their monthly bills. So congratulations. But, of course there's a but. If you're seriously nerdy and you want to know more about enhancing your finances, then this chapter is for you. We'll cover a few topics that'll help you maintain your system. We'll also cover optimizing your investments even further. Remember though, this is extra credit, so don't feel the need to follow the advice in this chapter unless you really want to. Get honest about why you want more. I was raised to be the best, to study harder, work longer, and perform better than everyone else. In many ways, those lessons have paid off. But I now also see the dark side of blindly following the idea of being the best without reflecting on why you're working so hard. So before you read on, ask yourself what the point of all this work is. Is it to earn an extra $10,000 or to actually live a rich life? Sometimes financial advice just blindly encourages people to do more without stopping to ask, is this enough? The concept of winning becomes the goal instead of knowing why you're playing in the first place. When do you get to stop and enjoy all the hard work you've done? I've seen too many people decide to take control of their finances, which is good, then change their lives to save money, also good, then continue saving and become increasingly aggressive, not so good, and finally end up living in the spreadsheet, where they spend each day counting how much their money has grown. Very bad. They've become obsessed with the game without realizing why they're playing. You do not want to live in the spreadsheet. Life is more than tweaking your asset allocation and running Monte Carlo simulations on your investments. At this level, you've already won the introductory game. Now it's time to ask why you want to keep going. If the answer is, hey, I want to take a lavish vacation every year and splurge on first-class tickets, great. If your answer is, I'm saving aggressively for the next 3 years so we can afford to move to our dream neighborhood, awesome. I can show you how to achieve both those goals even faster. To do that, let's go through an exercise I call taking it from the clouds to the street. When I ask you, why do you want more? The common answers are words like freedom and security. Now, those are fine, but I want to challenge you to go deeper. The problem is that with those high-level, vague visions, they don't really motivate us as much as we'd hope. True motivation is often real, concrete. It's on the street. It's something that affects us day to day. If you had to get extremely specific about why you want to earn your next $10,000, and I challenged you to bring your answer from the clouds to the street, what would you say? What's your street-level motivation? Sure, you could create some lofty life purpose, or you could take a 10-minute walk and figure out what gets you excited at this exact moment. The answers are often a lot simpler than you think. Your motivation could be taking a taxi to happy hour at 5 p.m. instead of sweating on the train. That's what mine used to be. Or it could be paying for a friend to join you on a glamping trip. One of my early street-level motivations was being able to order appetizers when I ate out. For this book, my street-level motivation is to answer the same questions I get asked about every single day when it comes to money, and to tell a few hilarious jokes. That's it. It's as simple as that. So, here's my question to you. Why do you want to earn the next $1,000 or $10,000 or $25,000? Don't give me an answer that's in the clouds. Get brutally honest and bring your answer down to the street. Daniel Snow, who's 38 years old, wrote, "Two of my favorite things are concerts and coaching high school lacrosse. Thanks to my job and salary, I'm able to buy VIP tickets to concerts and have scheduling flexibility to hold a full-time job in addition to coaching high school lacrosse." And Els Jones, who's 44 years old, wrote, "When I go grocery shopping, I don't look at the prices of things. I get whatever I need and whatever I want. Before, I needed to figure out how to make $50 work for the week. Now, if a recipe calls for a pound of Gruyere, I'll get it. I might be surprised at the register, but it's all good. I don't need to take anything back." Now, if you've gotten clear about why you want more, let me show you a few things you can do to achieve it. How to accumulate more and grow faster. Feed your system. In the previous chapter, you chose your investments and set things up so they run automatically. The automatic system is great, but it's fueled by only one thing: the money you feed it. That means that your system is only as strong as the amount you put in it. The earlier chapters in this book were about implementing the 85% solution. Remember, getting started was the hardest and most important step. It didn't matter if you were only contributing $100 a month. Well, now it's about the raw volume you put into your system. More in, more out. This is where your purpose comes in handy. For example, if you want to fire, remember, financially independent, retire early, if you want to fire in 15 years, then you know to double down and save and invest aggressively. Alternatively, if you want to live large in Manhattan, you could give yourself a generous spending plan for cocktail bars and seamless delivery. That's a decision I know well. Of course, the very best is to say yes and yes. Yes, I want to save aggressively, and yes, I want to live an incredibly rich life. With enough planning, and depending on your goals, a high enough income, you can often do both. Remember, because the rewards of investing as early as possible are so tremendous, one of your key drivers will be feeding as much as possible into your system. To put it another way, if you found a magical money machine that took in a dollar and spit out five, what would you do? Well, it's obvious. You'd put as much as you possibly could in it. The only catch is that it takes time. Every dollar you invest today will be worth many more tomorrow. Alyssa McQuestion, 34 years old, wrote, "I automated my savings so that I was saving a substantial amount while paying off credit card debt. This allowed me to pay for a wedding and also buy a house at the bottom of the market in San Diego. My home increased in value from $250,000 to $700,000, and the absurdly low mortgage payment allows us to live relatively stress-free in a popular, beautiful area. How rich will I be?" Well, let's talk about how much your monthly investment will be worth over time, assuming an 8% return. The point of this is to show you that now we are focusing on the volume. More in, more out. So let's take a look. If you're investing $100 a month, after 5 years, you'll have just over $7,000. After 25 years, you'll have over $95,000. What happens if we move that number up to $500 a month? Well, after 5 years, instead of $7,000, you'll have over $36,000. And instead of $95,000 when you invest $100 a month, when you invest $500 a month, you'll have over $475,000 after 25 years. I want to give you just one final example. Let's say that you get aggressive and you decide to invest $1,000 a month. Again, 8% returns. After 5 years, you'll have over $73,000. And after 25 years, over $951,000. Don't just take it from me, though. Go to bankrate.com and open up one of their investment calculators. Type in your monthly investment contribution and assume an 8% return. You'll likely see that your current contributions will grow slower than you thought. But add a little bit per month. Just play around with the numbers. Add $100 a month more. Even add $50 a month more. And watch those numbers change dramatically. Be sure to go to the end 30 or 40 years from now and see how much of your growth happens in those later years. That will tell you that starting now and contributing aggressively is one of the most important decisions you can make in your life. In Chapter 4, I outlined the conscious spending plan that suggested general percentages of income to allocate for savings and investing. Now remember back then, your first goal was to aim for those percentages. Now it's time to move beyond those amounts so you can save and invest as much as possible. I know. Invest more? Hard to squeeze out another cent. This is not me wanting to deprive you. Actually, quite the opposite. Because compounding works so effectively, the more you save now, the more you'll have later. And I'm talking about a huge amount. You saw this in the bank rate calculator. Now go play with your conscious spending plan. See how much you can eke out. Can you save an extra $50 a month? $100? Maybe more? See if you can do that every single month to put towards your investments. Optimizing your plan might involve doing some serious bargaining, like when you make a major purchase, such as a car or a house. I'll cover that in the next chapter. Or you might need to cut your expenses as ruthlessly as possible, which I cover on my website. Just search for Ramit Sethi Savings. You may even think about negotiating a higher salary or getting a higher paying job. No matter how you go about it, be sure that you are shoveling the maximum amount possible into your system every month. Remember, it's never easier to do this than now. And the more you feed into your system today, the sooner you will reach your goals. Michael Steele, who's 40 years old, wrote, "I went from manually paying my bills every month to automatically paying my bills, automating savings, and planning the whole year's worth of expenses. Now I've even automated monthly donations to charity as well. I almost never worry about money, and after growing up with the constant struggle of money being short, this really makes me feel a lot better." Rebalancing your investments. If you've chosen to manage your own asset allocation, you're going to have to rebalance from time to time, which is one reason that I highly recommend target date funds, which handle this for you. Now, if you've chosen a target date fund, good news, you can skip this section. But if you haven't, here's what you need to know about rebalancing. When you have a diversified portfolio, some of your investments, such as international stocks, will outperform others. To keep your asset allocation on track, you want to rebalance once a year so your international stocks don't become a larger part of your portfolio than you intended. Think of your investment portfolio like your backyard. If you want your zucchini to be only 15% of your backyard and they grow like crazy and end up taking 30%, well, you're going to want to rebalance. And you can do that by either cutting zucchini back or by getting a bigger yard so that zucchini is back to covering only 15%. I know. First personal finance, next organic gardening. You got a true Renaissance man on your hands here. All right, let's say you create an asset allocation based on the Swensen model. Recall that in the Swensen model, 30% for domestic equities, 15% for developed world international equities, 20% for REITs, 15% for government bonds, 15% for TIPS, and 5% for emerging market equities. Now let's assume for a minute that domestic equities gain 50% 1 year. And just to keep the math easy, let's hold all other investments constant. All of a sudden, domestic equities represent a larger part of your portfolio and all the other numbers are out of whack. You're going to see that after domestic equities jump 50%, in your overall portfolio, domestic equities now represent 45%. TIPS are 12%, government bonds are 12%, REITs are 16%, emerging market equities are 4%, and developed world international equities are 12%. Basically, everything's out of whack. Although it's great that one of your investment areas is performing well, you still want to keep your allocation in check so one sector isn't disproportionately larger or smaller than others. Rebalancing your portfolio will make sure your assets remain properly allocated and protect you from being vulnerable to a specific sector's ups and downs. The best way to rebalance is to plow more money into the other areas until your asset allocation is back on track. How? Well, assuming your domestic equities now represent 45% of your asset allocation, but according to your plan, they should only be 30%, here's what you do. Stop sending money there temporarily and redistribute that 30% of your investment contribution evenly over the rest of your investment categories. You can do this by pausing your automatic investment to particular funds from within your investment account. Just log into your account, find the fund that's out of whack, and stop the automatic contributions. You can resume that at any time. In other words, stop investing in the outperforming area and grow the other parts of your portfolio until your allocation is back in line with your goals. Now, there is another way to rebalance, but I don't really like doing it. You can rebalance by selling the outperforming equities and plowing the money into other areas to bring the allocation back under control. I gotta tell you, I hate selling because it involves trading fees, paperwork, and thinking, so I don't recommend it. Don't forget to set a calendar reminder to resume your automatic payments for the asset class you paused once the portfolio is rebalanced. Now let's talk about another example. This time when one of your funds has lost money, that's also going to knock your asset allocation out of whack. In this case, you can pause the other funds and add money to the loser until it returns to where it should be in your portfolio. To keep the math simple, I recommend the free financial dashboard at Personal Capital to help guide your rebalancing. And remember one thing, if you've invested in a target date fund, this will all automatically be taken care of. Yet another reason I like them. Stop worrying about taxes. Taxes are tribal. They're one of the most politically heated topics of all. And when it comes to taxes, I've learned that people really, really don't like being told that what they've believed for 25 plus years is wrong. So when I share 6 thoughts about taxes, some of you are probably going to get mad at me. That's fine with me. Here's what I want. I want you to be educated about taxes. And then I want you to notice how many people unthinkingly repeat tropes and cliches when it comes to taxes. Tax truth number 1. People think getting a tax refund is bad. In reality, it's great. Here's the myth. Getting a tax refund is bad because you've given Uncle Sam an interest-free loan for a whole year. The reality is, you would have spent that money. We know this because we have data, and that data shows us that small tax refunds that are gradually added to your paycheck get spent. Frankly, most Americans spend almost every last dollar they get. However, guess what happens to big tax refunds? Those tend to get saved or used to pay off debt. Surprising fact, this is why politicians have a hard choice to make when it comes to tax cuts. Give people small tax refunds over the year and they'll spend it, which stimulates the economy, but they won't realize they're getting more tax money, and therefore they won't give the politicians credit. Or the politicians can give them a big tax refund, and your administration will get good press, but guess what people will do? They'll save it or pay off debt, which means they won't stimulate the economy. Tax truth number 2. The U.S. is not the highest taxed nation in the world. The myth. America is the highest taxed nation in the world. Reality, not even close. Surprise, notice how many basic facts like this are simply lied about. If we can't even agree on basic facts, how can we expect to agree on tax policy? Also, if you're a tax nut opening up your email and typing 30 pages of crackpot theories and YouTube videos, don't bother. I'm right. Tax truth number 3. People actually think it's better not to make more money for tax reasons. They are wrong. The myth. Making more money will move you up in tax brackets, causing you to get taxed more and actually earn less. Reality. Please, for the love of God, spend 3 minutes learning about something called marginal tax brackets. If you start earning more and you move up tax brackets, the marginal amount or the money in the higher tax bracket is taxed at a higher rate, not the entire amount you earn. I can't even believe this is even something I have to say. As Christy, a commenter on my website, wrote, I've known people who refused raises for years because they think the new tax bracket will lower their income. If you try to explain reality to them, they become furious. They are so convinced they would rather complain about it than learn how it works. At this point, if they learned they were wrong all this time, they would feel so foolish that they would rather go on believing incorrect things than learn they were wrong. I know someone who believes that he has to pay his $3,000 deductible upfront every single time he goes to see a doctor. He becomes irate and refuses to listen if you try to explain how deductibles work. He'd rather just complain about his health and not go to a doctor because each trip would cost $3,000, so he can't afford it. He tells everyone about Obamacare ruining his life. I think he just enjoys complaining. Surprise, the people who believe this will go their entire lives without spending 5 minutes learning how tax rates actually work. At a certain point, their incorrect opinions become so entrenched that it's impossible for them to admit they were wrong and accept the truth. Good times. Tax truth number 4. People get really angry about how their taxes are spent, but they actually have no goddamn idea where the money goes. The myth: we spend a ton of money on foreign aid. Reality: out of every $100 in federal taxes you pay, around 1% goes towards foreign aid, which is way lower than most people think. Surprise, people are clueless about where their tax dollars are spent. They also love to say, I don't mind paying taxes, as long as it doesn't go towards XYZ. Thanks, but that's not how taxes work in a democracy. Tax truth number 5. People think rich people just use loopholes to never pay taxes. The myth: there are a lot of loopholes for the rich. Reality: I know about these loopholes. There are a few legit ones, like tax efficiency in your investment accounts, maxing out your tax-advantaged accounts, and a few more, but not nearly as many as you might think. In general, those loopholes are few and far between and largely available to the super rich who earn millions via capital gains, not ordinary salaries or even high salaries of people like lawyers and bankers. Surprise, there are certain loopholes for the super rich that you probably haven't heard about. If you earn multiple six figures, go to my website for my course on advanced personal finance. Tax truth number 6. Your politics cloud your rational judgment on taxes. The myth: people think their beliefs about taxes are rational and fair. Yes, even you. Reality: your personal psychology, along with your sources of information, play a huge role in what you believe about taxes. As Psychology Today noted, people have a number of general beliefs about what kind of exchanges should be taxable, and they want tax law to fit with those beliefs. When tax law conflicts with those beliefs, then people think the tax is unfair. Now, here's an idea for you. Next time you hear someone ranting and raving about taxes, ask them this: it sounds like you don't like taxes. Out of curiosity, what do you think your taxes get you? Now, this does 2 things. Number 1, it shifts the conversation away from the scarcity-based pandemic of people who see taxes as taking something away from them to seeing them as the price you pay as part of a democracy. And number 2, you will quickly determine whether this person is worth having a rational discussion with. For example, if they say, "We should privatize roads," or "All taxation is theft," just get up and silently walk away. Whenever taxes come up, you're going to hear a lot of nonsense. Take note of it, analyze it critically, and make your own decisions. Here's my take. I'm happy to pay my taxes. I take advantage of every legal tax advantage I have, like using tax-advantaged accounts, but I know that my taxes contribute to an overall system of stability. I also know that I can always earn more, so I don't use taxes as the primary factor in my decisions. Finally, if you ever get the urge to complain about taxes, go take a ride on a road anywhere in the world. Notice the difference in infrastructure? So please, give me a break, pay your taxes, and be a contributing member of society. Taxes are a great example of where you can apply the 85% solution. Remember, with the 85% solution, make a few key decisions, get good enough to be mostly right, and then move on with your life. So the 85% solution when it comes to taxes is to take full advantage of your tax-deferred accounts. If you're doing this, you're saving thousands of dollars in taxes every year. Now, once you get deeper into personal finance, I can already tell you what's going to happen. You're going to stumble across lots of outlandish claims of ways that you can shield your money from taxes. Listen, I have a ton of expensive advisors. I've looked into all these options. Nearly all of them are BS. Yes, if you earn hundreds of thousands of dollars each year, you may have a few additional options. But the real rich people tax benefits begin when you're earning millions of dollars from your existing investments. So focus on growing your money and hitting that 85% solution when it comes to taxes. The one thing you need to know about taxes and investments: invest as much as possible into tax-deferred accounts like your 401k and IRA. Because retirement accounts are tax-advantaged, you'll enjoy significant rewards. Your 401k money won't be taxed until you withdraw it many years down the line, and your Roth IRA earnings won't be taxed at all. More importantly, you won't have to worry about the minutiae, including picking tax-efficient funds or knowing when to sell to beat end-of-year distributions. By moving towards investing in tax-advantaged retirement accounts, you'll sidestep the vast majority of tax concerns. Investing in tax-advantaged retirement accounts is the 85% solution for taxes. Set it up, then move on. The Annual Financial Checklist. It's important to maintain your automated financial system. Every year, I spend a few hours re-reviewing my system and making any changes necessary. For example, have I added subscriptions that I don't need anymore? Or should I adjust my conscious spending plan to account for new short-term goals? Set aside some time every year. I recommend December so you can start the year off right and go through each of these steps. First, evaluate your conscious spending plan. This should take about 3 hours. Use these as general guidelines, but take them seriously. If your money is following these suggested percentages, that's a big win towards a rich life. Fixed costs, 50 to 60%. Investments, 10%. Savings, 5 to 10%. Guilt-free spending, 20 to 35%. Reassess current subscriptions and cut them if necessary. Renegotiate your cable and internet bills. Revisit your spending goals. Are they accurate? Are you actively saving for them? If your fixed costs are too high, it may be time to look at a cheaper rent, or Airbnb-ing a room out, or even earning more. And if you aren't investing at least 10%, it's worth finding the money from somewhere else, usually guilt-free spending, and then reallocating it towards investments. Next, negotiate any fees. This will take you about 2 hours. Many companies will offer you introductory rates, or they'll lower your monthly fees if you just ask. Use my word-for-word scripts at iwillteachyoutoberich.com/negotiate. Here are some of the places that you can negotiate. Cell phone bill, car insurance, cable and internet, and bank fees. Next, investment, which should take you a couple of hours. Confirm that you're contributing the max to your 401k and that your money is being invested, not just sent over and sitting there. Make sure it's also being invested in the right places. Confirm you're contributing the max to your Roth IRA and also that your money is being invested. Be sure you're taking advantage of all your tax-advantaged accounts. Next, debt. This should take a couple of hours. Revisit your debt payoff plan. Are you on track? Can you pay any of your debt off sooner? Check your credit report and credit score and renegotiate your credit card's APRs if possible. Next, credit cards. This should take about an hour. Make a plan to use your credit card points. Some of them might expire, some of them might not, but just remember, you earned them. Now have fun with them. Call to ask what other perks your credit card offers that you haven't taken advantage of, and confirm you're not paying any unnecessary fees. If you are, try to negotiate them down. Next up, earn more. You can negotiate a raise, which I cover in this book. You can also make money on the side. You can visit my site, iwillteachyoutoberich.com, for ideas, examples, and courses. Finally, here are some other areas that you can optimize once a year. You can review your insurance needs, including renter's insurance and life insurance. And if you have dependents, create a will. Why you should think twice about selling. I've never sold a single one of my investments. Why would I? I'm investing for the long term. But I still get questions about selling investments. In general, anytime you sell your investments, you'll be eligible to pay taxes when April 15th rolls around. The government has created incentives for long-term investing. For example, if you sell an investment that you've held for less than a year, you'll be subject to ordinary income tax, which is usually 25 to 35%. Most people who buy a stock and make $10,000 in 9 months and stupidly decide to sell it really only pocket $7,500. If, however, you hold your investments for more than a year, you'll pay only a capital gains tax, which is much lower than your usual tax rate. For example, Take the same person who sold their stock in 9 months and paid 25% in ordinary income taxes. If they'd held that stock over a year, then sold it, they would have paid only 15% in capital gains taxes. In other words, instead of only netting $7,500, they would have ended up with $8,500. Now, imagine that happening with $100,000 or $500,000 or millions of dollars. If you save and invest enough by following the IWT system, those numbers will become extremely likely. This is a small example of big tax savings from holding your investments for the long term. Here's the trick. If you've invested within a tax-advantaged retirement account, you don't have to pay taxes in the year that you sell your investment. In a 401k, which is tax-deferred, you'll pay taxes much later, when you withdraw your money. In a Roth IRA, by contrast, you've already paid taxes on the money you contribute, so when you withdraw, you won't pay taxes at all. Since you presumably made a good investment, why not hold it for the long term? In Chapter 6, I covered how people can't time the market. In Chapter 3, I showed you how buy and hold investing produces dramatically higher returns than frequent trading. And once you've factored in taxes, the odds are stacked against you if you sell. This is yet another argument for not buying individual stocks and instead using target date funds or index funds to create a tax-efficient, simple portfolio. Remember, all of this assumes that you made a good investment. Bottom line, invest in retirement accounts and hold your investments for the long term. Knowing when to sell your investments. When you're young, there are only three reasons to sell an investment. You need the money for an emergency, you made a terrible investment and it's consistently underperforming the market, or you've achieved your specific goal for investing. You need the money for an emergency. If you suddenly need money for an emergency, here's your hierarchy of where to get it. Number one, use your savings account, which you established in Chapter 2. Number two, earn additional money. Drive for Uber, sell old clothes, pick up tutoring. You might not be able to earn a huge amount in a short time, but selling some of your own goods is an important psychological step. It will let you prove how serious you are, both to yourself and to your family, which turns out to be really helpful if you end up asking them for help. Number three, ask your family if you can borrow money from them. I know, this doesn't work if your family's crazy, but it is an option. Number four, use the money in your retirement accounts. You can always withdraw the principal you contributed to your Roth IRA penalty-free, although you will be severely retarding your money's ability to compound over time. With a 401k, you can take money out for hardship withdrawals, which typically include medical expenses, buying a home, tuition, preventing foreclosure, and funeral expenses, but you'll probably still pay early withdrawal fees. If it comes to this, consult your HR rep. But I really urge you to avoid cashing out your retirement accounts because of the penalties and taxes involved. Number five, use your credit card only as a last resort. I cannot emphasize this enough. The chances are very good that your credit card will gouge you as you're repaying it, so don't do this unless you're truly desperate. Financial options for super achievers. Make the 10-year plan that few others do. You know, I gotta tell you, I love getting emails from people who've optimized their personal finances and they want to know what's next. My answer? Just ask people 5 to 10 years older than you what they wish they'd started earlier, then do that. You'll get three answers right off the bat. Number one, create an emergency fund. An emergency fund is simply another savings goal that's a way to protect against job loss, disability, or simple bad luck. Especially if you have a mortgage or you need to provide for your family, an emergency fund is a critical piece of being financially secure. To create one, just set up an extra savings goal and then funnel money to it in the same way that you would your other savings goals. Eventually, your emergency fund should contain 6 to 12 months of spending money, which includes everything. Your mortgage, payments on other loans, food, transportation, taxes, gifts, and anything else you would conceivably spend on. Number two, insurance. As you get older and more crotchety, you're going to want more and more types of insurance to protect you from loss. This includes homeowner insurance, like fire, flood, and earthquake, and life insurance. Now, if you own a home, you do need insurance, but in general, young single people don't need life insurance. First of all, statistically, we hardly ever die, and the insurance payout is useful only for people who depend on your livelihood, like your spouse and kids. Beyond that, insurance is really outside